Well, I once had a preaching professor who said that preachers should begin their sermons with a joke. And to this day, that professor, who is now a bishop, starts his sermons with a joke. Usually, it's a farmer in the field joke, and it goes on from there. Well, I'll spare you the joke that I found, because it was really not very good. It involved three pastors going into a bar. Jesus was the bartender, and what went on was the telling of this parable of the talents. Let me just remind you of the highlights of the parable. We have an unjust master and three slaves who are given talents. Now, a talent would be worth $6 million in today's monetary scheme. So this is a ridiculous amount of money, more than they can even imagine. So the first slave makes another 5 talents. The second makes another 2. They are invited into the joy of their master, which, if we read this as a parable about our salvation, into heaven. But the third slave buries his and returns his 1 talent to his master. For this he is cast into the outer darkness. And since this is, again, supposedly about salvation, we conclude that he goes to hell. Even though the joke wasn't great, it made a good point, which is why I tried to shoehorn it in. One of the pastors in the joke was from Africa, and he had this to say about the parable. Where I come from, my parishioners do not automatically assume that the unjust master is God. To their minds, this is a terrible story about a greedy landlord and selfish competing servants, and one frightened man who was punished for no good reason. Nobody wins in this story. Here's what they ask me. Why did the one with the 10 talents not help the one who was afraid? Why did the one with the 10 talents not help the one who was afraid? It's easy to preach this parable as God rewarding the rich and having no expectation about responding to the needs of others. We can create a circular assumption. God has blessed me by making me rich, and I am rich because God has blessed me. At its most explicit, we call this way of thinking and believing the prosperity gospel, and we see it in the preaching of figures such as Joel Osteen and Donald Trump's spiritual advisor, Paula White. Although in its defense, prosperity gospel preachers do stress the need to help others, so it's not completely like the parable. And this way of thinking and believing has found its way into popular culture as well. Let's listen to Oprah. She says, "Nothing about my life is lucky. A lot of grace, a lot of blessings, and a lot of divine order. But for me, luck is preparation meeting the moment of opportunity. Luck is preparation meeting the moment of opportunity. Thinking and believing in this way is all well and good when things are going smoothly, when life is going well. But when things go wrong, this can become a form of self-blame. If preparation meets opportunity, then I must have missed the preparation or the opportunity, right? When things aren't going right." I think we can see the dangers of pushing this way of thinking and believing too far. But let's return to the question that African pastor asks. Why did the one with the 10 talents not help the one who was afraid? This is a very different way of looking at the parable, and it echoes a statement that Jesus makes in another parable. He tells another story of a master and his servants. Just as in our parable, the master leaves on a journey, and when he returns, he finds that one of the servants has been abusing his power. In his comments about this, Jesus says, "From everyone to whom much has been given, much will be required." In the context of our salvation, this sounds like we can earn our way to heaven by doing what Jesus requires. But if we take these parables, as our African pastor would ask us to do, as tales to instruct us to do what is right, then this applies to our behavior anyway, not as a way to earn God's favor, but as a response to all that God gives us. We, like everyone else, are God's beloved, created in the image and likeness of God, who gives us all that we are and all that we have. Although this takes us far from the original parable of the talents, I want to talk about how Trinity is responding to Jesus' words, of whom much will be, much is given, much will be expected. We have been given much in time, talent, and treasure. And we need to start our response with thinking about the strategic focus work that we've just done. As you'll remember, as a result of lots of conversation with you all over the summer, our consultant Andy Tillman helped us identify 6 core values. I'm not going to talk about all 6. I want to talk to you about 2 of them. First, diversity and social justice, and second, ministry and outreach. Diversity and social justice finds its basis in our baptismal covenant to strive for justice and peace among all people and respect the dignity of every human being. We as Trinity hold diversity as one of the most important core values we have. As a result, we have and have had a passion for social justice. We seek to defend the marginalized both locally and globally. But this commitment can cause some tension in our common life because it brings to the fore 2 competing ideas about what church is about. On the one hand, we can see the church as a place of retreat and respectability, where we tend to our relationship with God, both commonly and individually. And when we do so, then the concerns of the world may be distractions at best and stumbling blocks to salvation at the worst. On the other hand, following a strain of the teachings of Jesus, we can see the church as a natural defender of the rights and privileges of the marginalized. Now, no congregation holds one view or the other exclusively. It's a continuum. For congregations like Trinity, just how far we move towards one end or the other is what causes tension. For people who more closely align themselves with the first view, that this is about spirituality and a place of retreat from the world, they can become uncomfortable with talk from the pulpit or other venues, talk about the marginalized or the oppressed, because often these folks are socially unacceptable. And this focus also makes us uncomfortable because it throws light on our privilege. To talk about social justice in the context of this congregation and the Episcopal Church at large, I need to take you back 150 years to the Civil War. This debacle divided denominations. If any of you who know Methodist history, if there are any Methodists out there, it was almost 100 years of division between the Southern Methodists and the Northern Methodists. And they finally became the United Methodists, but it took them almost 100 years. The Episcopal Church managed to stay together, but they did so in a way that was treacherous. So the Southern Episcopal Church seceded. They formed their own church, but the bigger, the national church, the Northern Church, never counted them as having seceded. They simply said that those bishops were absent for the entirety of the Civil War. So it was a way to get around the tension, but it caused some trouble. After the war, as a result of the inaction and the suffering that this caused, Episcopalians as a denomination became more proactive in social justice causes, though this waxed and waned over the following decades. But by the 1960s, we were at the forefront of the civil rights movement. And more recently, we stood with our HIV-positive brothers and sisters when other churches and society ostracized them. And we fully accept LGBTQ folks at a time when many denominations still disapprove. In the last year, as issues of immigration and racism have come to the fore once again, congregations like Trinity wrestle with how to respond. Do we pray? Do we study? Do we act? Trinity will do all 3. For people attuned to social justice, they can forget that places like Trinity are not organizing and protesting agencies, but they are churches. Our brothers and sisters at the other end of the spectrum help keep all these ideas and activities grounded in and in keeping with faith, asking the question, how does all this relate to the gospel? Activities and positions that may bring about justice but do not advance godly peace, which goes hand in hand with justice, may not be appropriate. I was thinking about what happened in Charlottesville. Some of the people who were progressive took the tactics of their protagonists on the other side, using violence, and we would say that that never has a place in our common life, even as we struggle and strive together. Now, when congregations neglect the spiritual side and forget that they are called to spread the good news through evangelism, as well as to act for justice, they risk eventual collapse and closure. I was thinking about a congregation in Minneapolis that I knew, and it was right at the edge of the University of Minnesota campus, and it was filled with 1960s radicals. This was in the 1980s, so they're getting a little old, not too old, but they were getting old. And they had such a passion for social justice that they forgot about the need to bring other people into the congregation. And they dwindled and they dwindled and they dwindled and finally closed. So we have to do both things. Turning to our second core value, ministry and outreach, we find in this a similar tension with diversity and social justice. In our baptismal covenant, we promise to seek and serve Christ in all persons, and we value this highly at Trinity, both among ourselves and outside these walls. For many people, the primary emphasis may be internal, that we take care of the people next to us first, what we would call the work of ministry. An equally passionate group on the other side says that we should care for the least and the lost outside these doors first, what we would call outreach. And this has particular ramifications for our clergy. One line of thinking goes, if we are shepherds of this flock, we should be attuned to people's needs without having to be asked. And some of that is true. Just as in any relationship, as we live along together, clergy come to know some of who needs what. On the other side, if we are a congregation that seeks and serves outside these walls, then by extension, pastoral care is the responsibility of everyone, and yet clergy have a special role to play in that. Pastoral care and outreach are always intimately connected, and again, operate along a continuum. Being too far at one end or the other end causes tension. We also find a connection between our two core values of outreach and social justice. What role is the church to play in society? Are we to be part of the larger community, or do we primarily go out to feed the hungry and clothe the naked and then return here for our spiritual pursuits? Again, it is a continuum. However, with the rise of multiculturalism, the idea that America is a Christian nation has faded. And to use a sports metaphor, which I rarely do, this has leveled the playing field. People of all kinds of faith, Buddhists, Sikhs, Muslims, can bring their voices and bodies to the civic arena to work for justice, peace, and human dignity, both to influence public policy and to use resources of time, talent, and treasure to meet the needs of the least and the lost. In these areas of social justice and outreach, how we see our responsibility determines how we believe and how we act. And this vision of how we act and believe must be shared widely in the congregation. That takes conversation, open conversation, during which no one is cast into the outer darkness because he or she disagrees. As we live into these values more deeply, let us remember Jesus' words, to whom much has been given, much will be required. Much required in word and prayer and action. Amen.